All conversations and information exchanged during participation in this podcast or interaction on the doctor.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or physician medical advice or direction per se. You must always follow your medical professional's advice and direction. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Please understand, I am not playing the role of physician in this environment per se. I'm educating. I am a licensed physician with specialty boards in American Board of Internal Medicine and American Board of Addiction Medicine. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around for Old Time Radio's episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob.
Yes, and a bit of business to get out of the way. Of course, another episode of This Life, #YouLive. Check out the Opium series on Weekly Infusion. We put it up there now as a podcast with very interesting interviews alongside of the history of opium, written and produced by Michelle Poe. We're several episodes in at Dr.com. The whole installment is there. Also, check out Dr. Drew podcast at Dr.com. Robert Greene, amazing
guy.
Yeah. Ashley Winter, she's a young urologist, real expert. You have to go to the Dr. Drew podcast to hear these guys. Dr. Alva, Kevin Folta. I get into actually botany and all the weird fears people have about GMOs and stuff. I actually talk to real scientists and, you know, straighten things out. Also, we have a new podcast, the Dr. After Dark podcast. It's become very popular. It's a YouTube channel. And
it's going to become one person more popular tonight when I can watch it.
It's with the interview comedians. It's all on Your Mom's House with Tom Segura and Christina P. For mommies but not for kiddies, check it out. Don't listen during carpool time. And don't forget the first T-shirt is out. It's the Heather Charcoal T-shirt at merchmethod.com/Tom Segura. And finally, the KBC Daily Show I do at Lantweeden, either at kbc.com or, again, at dr.com. It's all there, as well as all the podcasts from Playroom Pods. And the Adam and Drew Show there, too. Me and Adam do a show every day, and you can check it all out at drdrew.com. Let's get to our guest, shall we? Lieutenant Colonel Alan B. West. He's a combat veteran, a former member of the U.S. Congress.
Congressman.
Presently a Fox News contributor. Director of the Booker T. Washington Initiative at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Senior fellow at the Media Research Center. Contributing columnist, townhall.com. And Lieutenant, welcome to the program. Or Colonel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dr. Drew. You know, please don't call me Lieutenant. I had a lot of nightmares from those years.
I'm sorry. Lieutenant Colonel. Colonel is the way to go. His forthcoming book is called Hold Texas, Hold the Nation. Interesting. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the things you look at, I've been living here in Texas for the past 5 years, and my last duty assignment was here in Texas at Fort Hood, and there's an incredible demographic shift because, without a doubt, Texas has the economic growth and prosperity. So many businesses and corporations are moving here, and they are coming from, if I'm correct, you're out in California, they're coming from California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey.
Oh, yes. Where these utopias, all these other states are such utopias, they're running to Texas.
Yeah, but the sad thing is that they're violating the one commandment that Lot was given by God and his family when they were leaving Sodom and Gomorrah. They're looking back. And so we see an ideological shift here. And the last midterm election cycle here in Texas was very telling when you look at the results in Dallas County, where I live, and Houston, Harris County, and some of those surrounding areas. And I think that when you look at Representative O'Rourke, who has said that he has put Texas in play, he really has, because the population shift.
Now, you're right. Part of a media research center, and before we hooked in with you, Bob and I were arguing about the impact of particularly cable news and print media on the acrimony in our society today. And I was saying, you know, because Bob recently opted out of media, right?
I've opted out. I'm out. I do no longer participate in any of the daily grind.
He said, he goes, I feel so much better. And after all, what are these things really, how are these things really affecting my life? And I said, it's the media making you feel this way. It's not the reality of our government. Would you agree with me on that, or am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything. I wish that we got back to the old days of, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, there were three channels back then, and you sat and watched Huntley Brinkley or, you know, ABC or CBS, and they just reported the news. But when you went to that 24-hour news cycle, which got started there in Atlanta with CNN, then you had to, you know, fill up that time with stories and a lot more opinionated of journalism has taken place.
Right, interpretations, opinions. The other thing I friends of mine who have done it already, did it in 2016, have been urging me not to pay attention to it. They've pointed out that on any given night, the numbers for, say, Tucker Carlson are like 2.6. That's 2.6 million people are watching Tucker Carlson.
I just looked it up yesterday.
1 million people are watching MSNBC. And 600,000 watching CNN. It's only 5 million people watching those things.
Correct.
So what about the other 345 million of us?
Right.
We're watching March Madness.
Right. No, we're raising our children and we're supporting our communities and we're doing
but we're being
what,
infected
what people
by
have
the,
done.
I'm
by
watching
the,
Netflix.
Yeah.
Right.
But we're being infected by the background hostility.
But why does everybody think that that's the true America?
A good question.
Well, because that's what the message that continues to be promulgated out there. Is that's what everyone is doing. You know, they're not going out and, you know, watching their kids play Little League baseball, even, you know, high school, you know, sports, or they're not just, you know, trying to spend time with the precious little time that they have as a family unit, where we still do have family units.
Because right.
A lot of the family has been broken down definitively in the community, you know, the black community where I grew up in. I grew up in the same neighborhood that gave us Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. back in Atlanta, and you rarely saw any kid without mother and father in the home. But now you only have 24% of black kids that have mother and father in the home. So I think that there's a desire to get back to having those close familial ties and bonds. And a lot of people aren't sitting around and listening to the Rock'em Sock'em Robots that we hear played out a lot of, on a lot of these news
channels.
So
what do you think? So this is my suspicion that a lot of things are going splendidly. In this last 10 days, I appreciate my life more. I'm more engaged with my neighbors. A neighbor came over to give us clothes for my daughter the other day. We talked for like an hour and a half. When I was caught up in the media storm of things, and you see everything through the prism of that, I'm forgetting that one of my best friends, one of my mentors, a conservative Republican from Las Vegas, we're best buddies. We work together every day for 2 years and respect one another.
Yeah.
The respect has gone.
Well,
right?
In the media.
And so how are you guys trying to help direct things in a better way?
Well, I can only speak for myself, and the thing that I try to do is always speak from a position of factual information and not with just pure emotionalism. And, you know, I've had someone, you know, once said to me that I disagree with your facts, which I kind of thought was funny, but that's how some people are because they become locked in on an ideological perspective that is emotionally driven. And I think that causes us this great amount of angst that we see. And we should not just withdraw back into our respective corners. We need to be able to come out and respectively debate issues on fact. And
okay,
we should
so let's debate the issues that you guys are talking about in Texas. Eventually, if you look at what's happened since the mid-60s to now, there's going to be a Californianization of America.
Saying. Well.
Well, there's going to be.
Texas.
When you listen to any millennial talk, whether it's in Wisconsin, I've been all over the country, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Texas, you talk to a millennial talk, you're talking to a Californian. So what do you do to combat that?
It's interesting that you say that because when you think about what has happened in Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado, you've seen a lot of population bleed out of California into those states. And they have trended to look more like California. And you're right, it's happening here. But one of the things I always, when I'm out and talking to people, I read them the letter that Lieutenant Colonel William Barrett Travis wrote on 24 February of 1836 from the Alamo. You know, he was the man that led 185 for 13 days to make a heroic stand against Santa Anna. And, of course, they all ended up losing their lives. But the thing that I explained to people is that when Travis wrote that letter, he was 26 years of age.
Sheesh.
And we don't share those simple things, saying that here was one of the great stands of our history for freedom. And we don't even know that the young man was 26. But yet, you know, a recent survey came out talking about how millennials now get stressed out because the batteries in their iPhones are drained. You know, can you imagine a 26-year-old today being surrounded by 3,000 Mexicans under the command of Santa Ana at a place called the Alamo and knowing that you're not going to get any reinforcements? Go write a letter says that, you know, I will not surrender. I will not retreat. And that it will only be victory or death because I will uphold my honor and the honor of my country.
Yeah, there's nothing.
That's how.
I don't think there's like. I don't think there's any courage like that in 70-year-olds in America at this point. You know what I mean?
And again, that's another thing that should be troubling to us when you think about. I served in two divisions in my time in the Army: the 1st Infantry Division and the 4th Infantry Division. Both of those units landed on June the 6th of 1944 at a place called Normandy Beach, the 1st Infantry on Omaha, the 4th Infantry on Utah. And the day that I took command of a battalion was June the 6th of 2002 at Fort Hood, Texas. And that was the same day when, of course, all of those World War II veterans, the few that are left, were there on the installation to remember that anniversary, and they had them attend my change of command. And when you tell me that we are not producing those same type of young men and women, I say that that's not the truth. Here in Texas, the most decorated soldier in World War II was a young man that disobeyed his mother to join the United States Army. That's Audie Murphy. So I believe
the
that
actor, the actor Audie Murphy.
The important thing for us in America is to go back and tell the stories that have made us unique, that has made us exceptional, has made us great, and talk about those incredible triumphs. My godfather was a Tuskegee Airman, William Sticky Jackson.
Yep.
And to have someone like that as a godfather, I mean, you can imagine the impact that it had on my life.
Yeah, and I read a lot of your stuff since yesterday when I got the briefing. One of the things that you talk about is capitalism, right?
And free market, free enterprise.
Yes. And so there's an extreme – capitalism is capitalism. I don't think you can neuter it. I don't think – it just is, and it's the way this entire world works. But there's an extreme envy and covetousness of extreme wealth in America that I think supersedes any honor. That's a real problem we need to look at, and that is this idolatry towards wealthy people and wealth, and not towards, like the letter written at the Alamo by the 26-year-old man, courage,
yeah,
a good life. You know, the Tuskegee Airmen, they were admired by all Americans. I don't think you have a real admiration of character and courage anymore. I think you have an admiration of .com wealth and billionaires and as much money as somebody can have, right?
Do you understand?
Just think about the comment that y'all made coming into this segment when you were talking about LeBron James not going to be able to play for the rest of the season because his hurt ankle. Well, we know the Lakers aren't going to make the playoffs anyhow.
Yeah.
But look at the society that we have in the United States of America where so many people are walking around wearing the jerseys of folks that play a game.
Right, exactly.
And I think you know where I'm going.
Exactly. Idolatry.
And so we have become that culture, that society. Look, people absolutely admired, you know, the Bart Starr or Jackie Robinson.
Well, let's
Robinson.
Talk about Jackie Robinson or Muhammad Ali. These are heroes culturally.
But you didn't see people walking around with jerseys. You didn't see this multi-million dollar. I mean, you know, you even see, you know, people walk around with the jerseys of certain college football players and athletes, you know, basketball athletes. And so I think, again, we need to go back. We stopped teaching history, really.
Oh,
we stopped teaching civics. We stopped teaching objectively.
So wait. So you've highlighted on two. You've landed on two big topics. One is the destruction of the nuclear family, which is not just an African American thing any longer. It's everywhere, and the lack of common understanding of what this country is about, largely based on no education about it, but also kind of no interest in it.
No interest is what I would say.
So what do we do with these? To me, these are the two big things. What do we do with these?
Well, I got to tell you, Dr. Drew, it starts in our homes, because no government can change it. There's no policy solution that can change this. And I think one of the failures in our society is that we have too often turned to people in, you know, state legislatures or governors or presidents or members of Congress or whatever to try to solve the problems that we are facing. And that sense of rugged individualism, that sense of inner pride and honor and character has been lost. And people ask me, you know, who was your role model? My dad was my role model. I mean, he was a man that, you know, born in 1920 in South Alabama, grew up in South Georgia. He fought for this country at a time when this afforded him all the rights and privileges that it did others. And so at the age of 15, when he challenged me to be the first officer in our family, that's what we need to do. We need to have in our home challenging our, you know, future generations.
Oh, no,
to, as
can't
the model
do that.
Of the United States,
we can't do that.
Be all you can be.
Hold on. The institutions we have will tell you don't do that. That could traumatize that child and put that child under
and
too much pressure.
That's my problem. We've got too many Dr. Spock philosophers running around. You know, think about this. You know, when kids were out, parents were out watching kids play Little League, baseball, soccer, whatever, and, you know, there was a kid that didn't get to play or whatever. What did the adults do? Instead of, you know, saying, I'm going to go and practice with John or Jane, I'm going to try to help them to get better and explain to them how they can get better. No, they said, we're going to give them a participation trophy.
Right. And that
will stop taking score. And so now you have a generation that is looking for their grown up.
I think it's in the child rearing itself. I'll give you an example. Whenever I did something, my dad is also my hero. And so when I was, say, 11, my dad had lessons like your dad probably did. When I was 11 years old, I was working in the bowling alley. He used to, you know, he's a pretty stern guy. He'd tell you what his life was like at whatever given age you're being an entitled bratty, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I respected it, and I believed it, and it was true. And now I think parents are fearful of coming down too hard on their children. I'm not, but a lot of my peers are, right?
Well, they are. They are. You know, I often tell the story, I played high school football, and, you know, back then, if you didn't lower your head to hit somebody, you considered a wimp. And we didn't have these great helmets
with pads.
And I remember the one time when I knocked myself out going head to head with a guy. And, of course, they gave you the smelling sauce. And I woke up over on the sidelines. And my mom had come down out of the stands. And she leaned over and she had that real soft, genteel Southern voice. And she said, baby, are you okay? And, you know, I remember saying kind of groggily, yeah, Mom, I'm all right. And this is what Mom said. She said, next time when you tackle him, you got to wrap him up.
That's right.
Those were, you know, those old Southern moms, you know, hey, no blood, no foul. Is your leg broken? You're okay. Get back on the bicycle. Well, you know, you didn't tackle the guy properly and that, you know, get back out there and do it better. Instead of saying, oh, my baby, you can't play football. It's too mean. It's too rough. Let's give you a participation trophy. No. I mean, when I went to school and the teachers or the principal said, we're going to call your parents, I begged them. I'd do anything they wanted. Do not call my parents. But now we have parents to go to school and they're going after the teachers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this is
it's a cultural societal shift that we have seen here in America. And like I said, no government can solve this. We've got to solve this ourselves.
Well, I think but I think the society will solve it. So I've been my pet subject for 20 years, right? So the generation, the way that we're talking about child rearing has already happened. That is millennials. That is the average 18 to 30-year-old right now was raised this way.
Yeah.
They're dealing with society. They're the first generation that did you see the sex report I sent you, Drew?
Yes. What do you think?
Young people are not having sex. You know why? Because they live with their parents when they're 30 years old.
I don't think it's just that. I think it's porn. I think pornography
and porn,
is,
yeah. Right? Technology.
It's kind of
but
true, though.
But it's a little hard to have somebody over to your house when you live
right.
with your parents.
Jordan lives here. I haven't seen any girls here.
When did you start living on your own, Drew?
17.
17. Me, 17. Nate, the man? 20.
I was
19. Susan, 19. You're talking about a generation who still live with their parents.
Well, I yeah. went home for a while.
To regroup?
No, because my roommate took all the rent money and spent it on
right, you had to regroup.
On blow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Was I a roommate? I didn't do that.
That's
custom. Okay, that's TMI, folks.
Sorry.
But you know what I'm saying? We now have a petri dish to study what happens to the millennials. Right? There's still, and I'm not saying every millennial. I'm saying in general, they're living at home with their parents. Right? They are very yep. sensitive. They want things their way.
Yeah.
That's created by how they were raised and how the societal norms. Society is not that. Society does not care what you think.
Right.
Society does not care how you feel about things. You either show up at work or you don't get paid.
Right. So right? There's see, that. Go ahead, Alan.
But see, that's the problem in that I know and I see young men and young women that are raising their right hand and taking that incredible oath to support and defend the Constitution
right.
of the United States of America. But those are the images that we're elevating. Sure, we see them on the, you know, the commercial ads, Marines, Army, Air Force, you know, Navy, whatever. But those aren't the people that every single day we're recognizing. That's not the image that every single day is proliferated, you know, on our media platforms. And I think, again, that's one of the failures of society. Think about how once upon a time you couldn't even think about running for president of the United States of America if you hadn't served in the military.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about serving in the military. I mean, maybe been
leadership.
In combat.
Yeah.
That's true.
But look at how we've drifted so far away from that because
here's another thing about your history.
The ultimate sacrifice. If someone was willing to lay down their life for this nation, then that person was qualified to be a commander in chief, to be a leader of this country.
But think about the perception about what we were talking about, young people knowing things. John F. Kennedy has now been made into a mythological Greek god or something, and the people don't know. He was a military person. I say it to every person
addict.
I talk. He's a military person.
And a drug addict.
Yeah. But well, the T-boat.
Terrible drug addict.
How he got the courage book is how he got elected.
Well, boy, you're buying some of the mythology.
What?
The father had somebody else write the book.
Well, I'm sure, but he was in the boat. And it was his mistake, actually, that got them in that predicament.
Yes, yeah. That's true.
Right?
That's
so
true.
We're dealing with facts. But in general, yes, you're right. America, his family wanted him to be president. He had to be in the military to be president.
Exactly.
And he was.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
And believe it or not, no liberals will believe this. Kennedy is the one that got us involved in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
People don't know that, Drew.
They're the same ones that want to tell you that
liberals
Reagan,
do not want to believe
they
that.
They also want to believe that Reagan closed the psychiatric hospitals, which you know who started the closure?
Nixon.
No.
Yes, it was.
Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act that began the process of closing psychiatric hospitals.
Okay, that may be a fact.
No. It's the fact.
It is a fact. But that then was manipulated over the next 20 years to save money.
Let me send you the article that goes through the history. You got it wrong.
Is someone disagreeing with someone else's facts?
Yeah. No.
I'm
not disagreeing with whatever the fact is of who started it. I'm saying that 20 years later, that was used as a cost-cutting measure in California to close the psychiatric hospitals.
Oh. Well, but the reason they looked there as an opportunity to save money was no doctors wanted to work in the facilities. They were decaying. They were atrocious because my profession wouldn't attend to them. So they went, all right, we'll close them. That's what happened. Let me send you the article. Here it is.
And
this
so
is New York Times.
Well, we know we can't believe them, according to our president.
There we go. How release of mental health patients began.
Right.
That you know when this article was written? 1984. and they had not yet. They were wondering why these things were closing. This is, they'd all closed already. How did that happen by 1984? That's what the article.
Because
about.
Reagan was governor in 68, started the beginning of the closing of the psychiatric hospital.
This is about New York
State. Oh, we need a break.
This is about New York State.
Yeah, we need a break.
So you and can we're read it?
Our guest is just standing by like, what the hell are they talking about?
I'm having a great time listening. Yeah.
Well, I'll give some more data on Alan. Guardian of the Republic is the book that's out now. Also, Old School Patriot, that's available on Stitcher, Apple Podcast, or the Old School Patriot. Wait. Yes, theoldschoolpatriot.com. We want to talk about opiates and suicide. Let me just... And veterans.
And the military.
And let me just give us to frame it with an email. I'm a Marine veteran, and recently a few Marines in my old unit have committed suicide. The deaths have affected over 300 Marines of the 3rd CEB unit. I don't know what that means. Can you write us, can you give us some knowledge on suicide prevention? So suicide, military, opiates, big topic. PTSD. Yeah.
What's your take on it?
Well, I'm on the advisory board of an organization that's based out of California called the Mighty Oaks Foundation that is a Marine-based organization, but it really does work with all the branches looking into this. Another group that I work with is called the #22Kill, and there's a ring that I wear on my trigger finger, on my salute hand. It's called the 22Kill ring because on average, 20 to 22 of our veterans are taking their lives each day here in the United States of America. And I think that one of the things that we have not done a good job of is in the training up before you go on these deployments. And these deployments, I want you to understand that they are horrific and they are very tough. I mean, you have some of our special operators that have been on 6, 7, 8 combat tours of duty. And it's not just the effects it has on you, it's also the effects it has on the family as well. So I think it is very important that we deal with this issue before there are deployments. We need to look at how we cut the length of these deployments down, 6 to 8 months, a year. Sometimes they had taken them up to a year and a half. I don't agree with when you have these breaks in the middle of a deployment and the soldier, sailor, airman, marine, or Coast Guardsman, they come back home for a period of a month, and then you ask them to reinsert themselves into a combat environment. That's very tough. That's very stressful on them and also the families. But as you are coming out of these combat zones, you also need a little bit of a decompression period so that you can start to, you know, assess some of the individuals, look at them, and you got to, you know, talk about these things. But when we get back here stateside, I think that, you know, too often a lot of people have just pushed veterans to the point of just saying, here's a bag of drugs, go take them and be well. We need to be able to have better counseling for our veterans. And yes, there is a stigma out there that a lot of young men especially don't want to be classified as having PTS because they don't want to be seen as being weak.
Right.
And then there's also this concern, and I'll be very honest about this, that their Second Amendment rights will be taken away from them. So they keep a lot of this inside.
Right.
So I think the Veterans Administration system has not done a good job in you know, outsourcing some of these young men and women to civilian agencies and civilian hospitals. You can't put people on a waiting list. You can't have people calling in on suicide lines and, you know, basically put them on hold. So that's one of the key things we need to do. But I think the most important thing is we've got to look at how we can tone down these deployments because we have a military that we have severely cut their in strength, but yet we're asking them to do more and more.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of good ideas here. I mean, one thing is the Second Amendment issue, which I didn't realize was a big issue for a lot of the veterans, which it is.
Yes.
Two is the machismo stuff where you don't want to feel like you're broken or you need help, need support. Three, you're right. You need to be again talking to the patient, you know, the injured soldier and the family immediately. But I love your idea of being more proactive throughout and before the deployment.
Absolutely.
You're 100% right. That is a piece we just have not put in place.
Well, I've been there. And you know, I remember when I deployed my battalion to Iraq back in 2003, there had only been two people in our entire battalion that had been in combat before, and that was myself and my command sergeant major. And what I tried to sit down and talk with, you know, especially the junior leaders and our soldiers about, was that you've got to understand that the person that you are here separated from the person you're going to have to become and the things you're going to be asked to do over there.
Yeah.
I remember when we were, you know, at the railhead loading up our equipment, and one of our young soldiers came up to me and asked if he could talk to me. And I said, of course you can. He said, I'm scared. He said, sir, I don't know if I can do what is necessary. And I told him, you know, I'm scared too. I said, my fear is that I will let 600 and some odd of you down. And I don't want to do that because I've got to make a commitment to you and to your families that I'm going to do everything I can to get you back here safely. And I think that it is very important that we come to face-to-face with our concerns, our fears, and we talk about them before we go into these combat zones. And I told my chaplain that he was the greatest combat multiplier in our battalion because our men would talk to him about things they definitely weren't going to talk to their sergeants, their officers, and certainly not me. And it was very important for him to circulate throughout the unit, circulate, get out on the battlefield, go on some patrols with them, to show these young men that he's with them and he's there to care for them each and every step of the way. So it's that continuum, Dr. Drew, that we have to have.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, this we're going to put the finger in the dike moment, you know, when it gets to critical mass.
Colonel West, thank you for your service. Thank you for your wise words. Thank you for Guardian of the Republic and the Old School Patriot podcast. And thank you for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. I look forward to doing it again, guys.
All right.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
We'll talk soon.
All the best. Bye-bye.
All right, so there you go.
We'll take another little break, and then Bob and I will get back together and fight about closing psychiatric hospitals.
No, I found my evidence in your own article.
Okay, good. Well, CBDs are everywhere, right? Everyone's talking about them, and it's a topic that I get asked about all the time. Bottom line on CBD, although there are way more claims made about them, the clinical evidence right now, it's not all that clear, but many people are using it and reporting great results, and they are very encouraging. So I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD is cannabidiol, an extract from hemp. While you might associate with marijuana, CBD does not cause reinforcement. It is not the reinforcing component of hemp, but it is what's responsible for the calming or some of the relaxing effects that many people experience, not the high. Now about the products. There are a ton of them on the market today. Forgetting the vast array of the reported health benefits, it's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not the hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is described to you so you can make an informed decision without all those promises that are probably too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD by individuals using this are very compelling. I'm excited to see how things develop as the science catches up with this booming industry. As usual, the public is ahead of the science. I can't make explicit claims yet, but boy, the reports are pretty encouraging. So if you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That's on my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. And for a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with the code Dr. Drew, DRDREW. Again, drdrew.com/select, and then the code DRDREW. And we are back. What'd you find?
Well, in that testimony in 1963 in the article of the one doctor that, you know, steered the whole thing.
Yeah.
It would save the state of New York $400 to $500 million in 1963. I went back, multiplied what that is in modern times. That's all, more than $2 billion saved by this just the state of New York.
He was wrong. They didn't save anything.
Well, that's what he said.
That's what he was claiming,
what he said in Congress.
Right, and that's why Kennedy went for it. And they were also saying it was cruel and it was unusual to, you know, when you have these new medicines and the only medicine.
Well, the drug they're using back then was Thorazine. Walk around like a zombie.
But they believed, the psychiatrists believed they were curing mental illness.
Not banging their head against the wall or trying to stab you with a pencil.
The point is, it was ill-conceived, ideologically driven. The money sold it, and it was all a bad idea sold to President Kennedy, and he signed the Community Mental Health Act, which, on its surface,
in 63, based on those congressional hearings,
he signed it, and that's where it went. It went completely in the toilet after that, fast. So within 20 years, all the other state governors were closing the rest of them because they just fallen into disrepair. and no doctors wanted to have anything to do with it because they don't mention in here the other nail in the coffin was the public perception because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I know, that movie had
massive
that,
impact.
But this started in the late 60s. Here's a fact. My Uncle Bob Thornblad, who I'm named after, mm-hmm. was a hospital administrator.
Okay.
He was on Governor Reagan's board about the nursing home and mental health facilities, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I went with him on a trip to Oakland in the early 70s, and he was friends with Reagan, and they had a falling out because it wasn't working. So I didn't know what was working, but now that I read this article and put two together, what wasn't working was what they had been told 7 years ago.
Right.
And so Reagan could have switched it around.
17 years ago.
That conference in Oakland was about this isn't working. Right. We have mentally ill people walking around the thing. We have elderly people sleeping on park benches.
Exactly.
We need to do something. And the idea was we're just economically – we're not going to switch back.
The problem was the federal government was withholding the funds to do it.
Because the decision had been made 7 or 8 years before.
17 years before.
63. I'm talking about 71. Oh, I went
8 years
thing.
Before. Right.
It was when Reagan was still governor.
Yeah.
So he could have changed it, but he would have to then turn around and tell the California taxpayers they're going to have to pay for it.
The federal government withheld all the money. So they were the ones that used to fund it. So what are you going to do? I mean, and by the way, my profession was...
Well, how much has it cost? All the homelessness, all the criminality, the incarceration, how much has it cost?
They didn't know that then.
They were starting to know it in the early 70s.
I'm telling you, have somebody who trained in the 80s, if you had done that in the 70s, my profession would have crushed you. That's cruel. How dare you? We can take care of these people. How could you do something so cruel? This is, who are you to say? My profession started this nonsense.
Just imagine, Patton State Mental Hospital in San Jose, which is probably now Google's headquarters, it's in Silicon Valley there along the 237 highway.
Yeah.
That was a huge mental hospital. By 1977, the last patients were being moved out of there.
Yeah.
Imagine if you'd been in there for 30 years and they were just going to move you to a HUD housing in San Francisco and you go get your meds down the street.
You're free.
If you've been in a place for 30 years.
Because that is the insanity of what my profession signed off on. You're cured. We got medicines now for you. You're cured.
And so
go free.
And so the modern homeless population is a culmination of government letting down veterans, government letting down the mentally ill.
Yes, that's it.
Right?
That's it. That's it.
That's who's on
it. That's it.
And now
everybody else is sort of temporarily homeless, and that's an economic thing, and we can kind of deal with that.
Right.
The chronically, permanently homeless is the problem. All right, let's take some emails.
Well, there's one that I wanted to get to that I have them. I've been looking forward to this segment the whole time, and now I lost the.
What did it have to do with? Maybe I have in front of me.
The suicide one, the long one.
Uh-oh.
Where is the suicide one? God, there's so many. A lot of people listen to this show.
I know. We're
okay, suicidal thoughts or fantasies.
Yes, I got
first,
it right here.
Okay, read it. Read, synopsize.
Oh, boy. Thank you. About a month and a half ago, I got a random urge to learn to try a noose. I couldn't.
He went on Google.
I couldn't.
And they teach you how to kill yourself on Google search.
Right. I can't help but put the rope
around
my neck.
Kids learn how to shoot up on Google. People get their shitty health care from Google. When is Google going to be held accountable?
So this guy was. This guy was not. This was a guy who was sort of flirting with
fantasies and sexual, Michael Hutchins type stuff.
This is
the fact that you can go on Google search and find out how to hang yourself, Drew.
Yeah.
Find out how to shoot up heroin.
Yeah.
What is it?
Contagious.
Neutrality? I mean, what's your stance on that?
Oh, I think we will look at the screen the way we look at tobacco eventually. That
you and I will be an old folks home by then.
Could be, but I think we will. But hold on. Let's see. I don't attach the end of a structure. I just wrap it around my neck. I start to lose consciousness.
He wants to auto-asphyxiate.
I don't have suicidal thoughts, but I have
fantasies, he says.
I have them. If I don't get a disease or shot or car wreck, I will definitely go out this way. So he's flirting with these fantasies of suicide, but liking the feeling of cutting the blood supply off to his head because he gets euphoria from that.
I could tell him just to buy some amyl nitrate and it'll do the same thing.
That is exactly true.
Right.
However, I would say this is a medical emergency.
I know. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. And this is a kid that needs to be, he's 1 month sober too.
It's crazy. The internet opens access to this real darkness, Drew. There is a moral responsibility to the society.
I agree.
How come they're not held accountable?
I don't know. That question enters my head 50 times a day. Why aren't the politicians held accountable for the people languishing on the streets? The infectious diseases that are going to break out this summer, why aren't these people held accountable? Why isn't Facebook held accountable for the garbage that was perpetrated politically?
Yeah.
Why not?
Why?
Why not? I don't know.
Why are we held accountable for every step we take?
Drew gets all the emails, so
huh?
No, we're getting all the emails.
So the way it came up with me is Yelp. Okay, can I talk for a second?
Please.
This is why I want to lead into this. We have a former disgruntled employee that worked for us that I had to let go. Mm-hmm. He, for some reason, just can't let it go. It has been 17 years.
Wow.
17 years. Mm-hmm. He keeps putting bad Yelp reviews on my rehab.
Yeah.
They're always anonymous.
Yeah.
Do you know that you can put up a bad Yelp review trying to destroy, with your intent of trying to destroy somebody's business, and you can remain completely anonymous?
Yeah. See, I think this kind of thing, there will be legal action eventually.
Why? It's been going on for 5 years that I know of.
No, I know. There's got to be some sort of legal pushback.
Yelp is the worst at it.
I agree.
You can just put up any mean thing about any doctor, any psychiatrist, any psychologist.
Then,
so I decided 2 years ago with Evan and Jared, I want off Yelp. I don't want anything to do with Yelp. I want all of our stuff taken off Yelp. Guess what? You don't have a choice.
Right.
That's not America.
I agree.
Okay.
I totally agree with you.
So I convinced you I just need to convince 349 million other people.
What do you think of the
I'm fairly
open to the idea of restricting things online. But just for the public health.
Right.
Yeah. But what about the
to hang yourself, how to shoot up heroin?
What about the young people?
Would you take those off the internet?
Yes. What about young people not having sex, that article?
Okay, well, I sent it to you. So, well, nobody's having sex, apparently, but you and I and Susan.
I'm having lots of sex.
Nobody's having sex, Drew.
You said it was because of the people.
No, but in all age brackets. One is because the population is elderly. Is
well, when
older.
I was 24, I met Drew. We both had our own apartments, so it does
there you
make
go,
a huge
24.
Difference.
But all demographics. Did you see the article? I sent it to your phone.
Usually, humans, like every other mammalian system, don't reproduce when there's risk. You know what I mean?
What's the risk? It's the greatest time in my life.
I think they perceive it. I think that's the media is probably creating it. Is it just an American phenomenon?
Yeah, there's only America that they were studying.
Right? What's different about here except the media? The craziness.
So people are thinking, but they're not having. There's ways to have sex that don't involve procreation.
I understand. I understand. But the way our system works is we will drop our drive if we're like we're dieting and things. Our drive.
So definitely porn for young people.
Yep.
The access to porn 24 hours a day at any given notice, that is affecting young people.
Yep.
The older population are. I always thought, I come from a nursing home background. There's people having sex in there.
Sure.
When a new guy would come in, Susan, you'll love this. So my family's nursing home in Culver City, it was like 80% women, and they're all like in their 80s or whatever. When a 77-year-old widower would come in.
Oh, yeah.
He would be holding court in the cafeteria. It was crazy.
I love it.
And I don't know that sex was going on, but flirting was.
They have sex at that age, Bob.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah.
Haven't you heard about all the women who get STDs in nursing homes?
In nursing homes?
Yeah, there's an outbreak in Florida.
Oh, my God. So anyways, but in general, there's less sex as you age, right?
Yep.
The middle part that was interesting is the married nuclear family marriages.
Yeah.
They're not having sex either.
Yeah, that's weird.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Maybe too many kids.
No.
So, you know, I remember on Loveline years ago, Drew used to always say, you know, that women had to put up with men so much and how they are the keepers of intimacy.
Women are.
Yeah, and I think what's happened in the last 30 years is women have finally figured that out. They're kind of going back to the old, you know, feeling of, you know, I don't need to have sex with this guy just because I go out to dinner with him. And, you know, or they're just very careful about who they get involved with. And especially if they're the same age group, like 24 to 30 year old women don't particularly want to go out with men their own age. You know, like Drew was an old soul when he was 24. He was like a 35 year old. But
I know, he's been the same since I met him.
Most 26 year old guys are just, you know, they're not quite.
You might be going backwards. You might be more. He might be more carefree and more youthful now than he was then.
Watch the Dr. Drew After Dark. I was thinking the same thing when I was doing. I had the same thought, Bob. Just so you know.
So why were you so serious early on?
You know why?
Why?
It's so strange you would bring this up. I was thinking about it in the shower this morning.
Wow.
Because I was so. I don't even have words to describe my level of commitment to the being a physician. I was it was so thoroughly
you had a shaming dad physician who was going to crucify you if you weren't excellent.
Yes, there was that, but I went way beyond that. I went way beyond it, and I internalized it so much.
Yeah.
Is there support groups for doctors, sons of doctors?
I don't know,
because there's so many. One client I had who's turned his life around. Dad still shames him. He's been sober since Hollywood Recovery, 9 years.
Yeah.
I can't believe he got himself involved with that.
Yeah.
Like, doctors are brutal. A rare breed.
Brutal.
Well, we don't have a ton of doctor friends. Most of our friends are Hollywood people.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of doctors of sons and daughters of doctors.
Because there was for years. Then the profession was so, they thought it was fun and so, you know, so much success tied to it. Now it's brutal, it's slavery. And you could make the same living as plumbing easily.
Yes.
Easily.
Okay.
You could be a travel agent.
Yeah, easily. The point I was saying.
Why were you so serious?
Yeah, everything about me was about that priority of physician. And that's why I could hold the line so well in environments like Loveline and things, because I was still younger, so I had some of that free-spiritedness that you're talking about. But I was preoccupied.
That's medical school.
Yeah. With the internal important, is what it was. I thought the profession was so important. I thought what it had to offer. I thought what I was doing was so, so important. And I feel like, this is the part of the conversation I had with myself this morning. I feel like the world just doesn't care.
They don't pay for it anymore.
That's the second time the world doesn't care has come up. But yeah. So interestingly, what do they care about? Is fame, money, right? And the proximity to fame and money, even if it's only that you're following somebody on Twitter and that you know what they said today, it's the weirdest society. So I've opted out for 10 days. I feel magnificent.
Good.
Nate doesn't even have a TV in his house.
I don't watch the news all day either.
Huh?
Jewel, did you hear about this? And I'm like, who's Mueller? I had to ask
him. Who's Mueller?
Also, Nate's saying he does have a TV. I was in your living room. You didn't have a TV in there.
Let me do some quick emails. Here, thanks.
Don't feel bad.
Here's
Bob.
A positive one.
I never
Bob.
Watched the
Thanks
news.
For Slippery Rehab. You've helped me more than you know. I was a 60 pill a day addict. Watching your content, TV and radio, gave me the strength to get sober and stay sober. I've been sober for 8 years. I run a $1 million company, have been very successful in my relationship. Thank you. There's somebody at Celebrity Rehab got
that's
sober.
That's inspired. I hear that all the time. You know, for some reason, people got inspired by Celebrity Rehab. They didn't even go inpatient treatment, but somehow they turned things around. It was a weird. I want to read the borderline one, so I'll read it. It's two pages.
Go ahead.
Borderlines. Why are borderlines attracted to sociopaths? Does the sociopath feed their narcissism?
Yeah.
You rock, dude. I think that's directed at me. So why is that there a fittedness between borderlines and sociopaths? Because we just talked about it on a prior podcast.
I think we didn't have to go to psychoanalytic literature to answer that question. But let me see if I can.
But I don't think the borderlines, the ones that I'm thinking of, the couples that I'm thinking of,
yeah.
that the borderline doesn't act like a borderline to the sociopath.
Yes.
They do it to everyone else, but when they're with that person,
right,
they're more contained. Borderline gets contained by the sociopath.
A narcissist contains the borderline a little bit, but the sociopath likes the drama. So I don't know.
But they're above it.
Yeah, they are bothered by it.
Yeah, they're not
bothered.
They're not caught up. They don't get caught up in the hurricane of it.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's almost like I think the borderline can have a relationship without having a relationship, right? Because a real relationship gets very scary for borderlines. Mm. And a sociopath's not really available for a relationship. They're available for fun, and they're available for, you know, maybe even some containment, but they're not really actually available for a relationship. Because borderline, as soon as you get close to them, they freak the hell out.
When you and Dr. Blum were educating me about borderlines, I didn't really know anything about it, and I won't go into the details, but there was one that we had, and it caused chaos in the unit, chaos everywhere, going to sue everybody, all kinds of chaos. And he and I were in your office, and I was just like, who would marry someone like this? And he pointed at me.
I did.
And, no, Barry did. Oh. He pointed at me, and he pointed at himself. I was like, what? I don't like that.
Addicts will. Yeah.
Yeah, he was referring to addicts.
Addicts functioning at a sociopathic level will.
Well, I think it all just the swirl of it all.
Yeah. Addicts get high off the swirl. So.
But
and it's also a smokescreen for their using, right?
Yeah, you don't have to. It draws attention away from their alcoholism.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's just a fittedness to every kind of personality type, right?
Yeah.
And it's not as superficial as it seems.
No,
it's more archetypal.
It's how you feel in the setting of close, intimate proximity.
Makes
it comfortable?
How the healthy person,
because
I think I was very unhealthy. I think I'm semi-healthy now. So how the unhealthy person feels around a healthy person is uncomfortable.
Correct.
This is not working. This is not.
Yes.
This is something about this person stuck up. The blah, blah, blah.
It just makes your skin crawl for
It doesn't work. Yeah. So unhealthy people are going to naturally fit better with other unhealthy people.
Absolutely.
Why? How come the healthy people don't click together? Because I don't see a lot of healthy couples either.
They do. You don't see them.
Where are they?
They're out there in the world. They're not a lot of them. You're right. These days, because we all come from such destroyed families, right? And so there's not a lot of good relationship health out there.
I remember I went on a date with a school teacher in New York City one time. She was just amazing, you know, like what you'd think, like, oh, my God. And I was just like, yeah.
Give it to her.
And when I walked her to the train, I was like, I'm never going to see her again.
Get on that train quick. That's
boring as shit.
Well, boring is the classic experience of
a narcissist with a normal, with a healthy person.
So that's how the narcissist feels.
Yeah, they feel like
bored. Yeah. Well, borderlines do too. Also,
they'll feel
bored.
They feel bored with normal people. Right.
Well, a lot of the narcissistic disorders. That's sort of the thing.
But here's the thing of why people don't talk about it. I think everybody sees their relationships with. They don't want to think that there's some unhealthiness that's gluing you together.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So
what's wrong with that?
Us together.
Well,
whatever's
imagine,
gluing you together
we can talk
is gluing
about our
you pathologies together.
If you want. I'm not sure we should do it right here. But
you're a little bit of a narcissist.
A little bit. But
not
then,
as much as me. Come on.
Not as much as him. But then so are you. So we're sort of
I don't want to think that I'm
but in a different
borderline
way.
Because I do like closeness. So I think
no, when you're
you
too
said,
matter of fact.
Yeah. I might have had a little tendency in my 20s though.
Right. So I have narcissistic tendency
what is it?
Trait.
What is it?
You have borderline tendency trait and there
I think
it goes.
I went through a phase between like 18 and 20. And it was just really weird because I was a completely different person. Then when I met you, I kind of like snapped out of it.
Glued it together. But again, it's these traits that are probably kind of fitting. It's not a disorder. It's sort of traits.
But why do people think of it? Because I bring it up a lot, and people feel very uncomfortable about it. They don't like talking about it. I say, well, whatever works, whatever's fitting, and if you have insight about who you are and why it fits, you can talk about it.
Exactly. You know who said that to me the first time? Florence Henderson.
Oh, my God. Florence, Brady Bunch.
Because, listen, Florence Henderson had a husband who was a therapist.
Oh, really?
And their big – this was in the 80s or maybe early 90s. And their big campaign was, it's okay that pathology brings you together.
Yes.
As long as
– You're aware of it.
Process. As long as you have process around
it. And talk about it.
Treatment, process, openness, look at it. Because it's the craziness that creates the fun and glue, right? It creates the intensity. But it can't be too much.
It can't be clingy, and I don't want you to change, right?
It can't be too much. It can't be where the intensity is the goal and not the love. And you got to have lots of process, lots of talking and openness.
And talk about this, because I read this article about how in a relationship, if you're going to have a 20, 30-year marriage, that somebody's going to get ahead.
Emotionally
ahead.
Yeah.
It's not like you have to wait. You just have to keep talking, and it'll change and get more comfortable. It might get uncomfortable for a while. It'll get more comfortable.
Well, this would be an interesting topic for our producer. So I went through all those years of therapy. Did you feel me changing or moving, and you had to change yourself in some way?
Mm-hmm. But you went a good direction.
Was he home more? No.
Well, we were also raising triplets. So
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Did it make you feel left behind in any way?
No.
No.
I'm not a clingy person. Maybe that's the borderline part I'm
What yeah, year no. were the triplets born?
92.
92. So when you and I started working together, they were 11. You worked from 7 in the morning till midnight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy, Drew.
Yeah. What's your point? Yeah.
How were you feeling about that?
Well, it paid for all the help, that's for sure.
Okay.
No,
we were in survival mode.
Listen, he came home for like an hour between, and he would just be hands-on. But at the beginning...
3 hours, 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, so he would be hands-on, super good with the kids and everything. He'd rile them all up and then go to Love Line, and then I had to calm them down. But he was great in that period of time. But when they were first born and they were really little, before he went to therapy, he would come home... And we'd sit and just stare at each other, and we wouldn't speak. The kids were like, all around us. And I would look across at him, and he would just look so angry. And then he'd yell at the kids, stop it.
That's your dad. You were being your dad.
I just looked at him, and I go, you're not handling this very well, and I don't think it's going to work out, so you need to get therapy. And he went and got it right away.
That's amazing.
It helped, yeah.
Well, she was like, no, listen to me. She was like serious. She goes, you need to go. Listen to me.
Well, at least
it cut right through me. I thought,
he yelled at one of my kids,
but your
and I
health,
was like, no.
But your health was, the healthy part of Drew was to focus on the kids. Because what I see unhealthy people do is focus on the wife that's not raising the kids right.
Ooh.
That's what you see a lot, the blame.
Well, there was kind of an edge of that, but I had been with these kids all day long with help, and I'd gone through 30 diapers and 30 bottles.
We were in survival mode.
And he came home for like 10 minutes, and this anger would just come into the room. And I knew he was stressing out about work. And I said, you're going to have to leave that like outside. Out the door.
Well, that's another thing.
I didn't even know what he did with the whole Las Encinas thing.
Oh, yeah. She didn't even know what that was all about.
If you're going to deal with what we deal with, you're going to have to come up with a game plan of how to have a life.
Yeah. Well,
and
that's what happened.
You can't help people unless you're 1,000%. And that's my problem with drug treatment is hardly anybody's 1,000% anymore.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I mean?
I know.
Like, I'm 1,000%. You know me.
Yeah.
Right? I don't give up. It doesn't stop because the clock stopped. And we had a staff that it didn't stop because the clock stopped.
That's right.
And then we had to tell each other, because you could just physically look at Shelly sometimes and say, you need to fucking take some time for yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But now you see a team that's all about them all the time. It's so weird.
I'm kind of curious though, Drew, when you came home and you saw me, was I doing something wrong that was irritating you, or was it just just a combination of everything?
I know.
A 12-hour day and three kids.
I was pretty stressed out for sure.
But you had one introverted kid, right? So there's only two really causing trouble.
No, it's in the early when it was just
Jordan,
you know,
had colic for 4 months.
Yeah, he's the introverted one. Had colic for 4 months. Oh, okay. So I mean, it was
that
just,
almost put me over the edge.
It was. I only am aware of my own responsibility.
But it was like you didn't like the food I served, and then I was like, well, you know, sorry.
But it
know.
Got serious in 2006 when we started the TV show. That it was 2006 or 2007.
When Douglas had a brain surgery.
No, 2007.
Oh, no. 7.
2008.
I can't remember somewhere what year. There. I don't even remember what year anything was.
So now, not only were we dealing with what we were dealing with, now we're under a microscope, which I didn't perceive as happening.
Oh, you're talking about celebrity rehab,
right? I didn't either.
Yeah, like that we were going to be the subjects of the thing, not the treatment and the clients, mm-hmm. even though... It's a strange thing because I was surprised at how much focus VH1 had on the clients. But no matter how much they tried to focus it on the clients, it came back at the three of us.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right? And yeah. It was strange.
It was very strange.
And that now I remember because I'll give you an example. I'm not a big fan of the national anthem being played at sporting events. Mm-hmm. I think you should keep politics out of sports like you should keep – right? So I would never take my hat off. Starting with the criticism or the microscope I felt we were under,
oh,
I didn't
boy.
Want to reflect poorly on him or Shelley or geez. Anybody, so I started taking my hat off and putting it over my heart.
Wow.
I swear to God. Because I knew that the three of us are in this world together now.
Yeah.
Right.
It was a very strange era.
No, but it was good.
Well,
it
was still
a good thing to do.
You know, still...
You
know,
I started taking my hat off and put it over
my
heart
are you,
for
dude?
You, Dr.
Thank
Drew.
You, Bob. I appreciate it.
You come home frustrated about something, and I go, well, why don't you just quit? Lawson Cenas. And he go, no. And then he wrote the book Cracked, and then I read it, and I was like, oh, my God, I didn't even know what you did all these years. Like, I had no idea. They wrote in the book, he writes about how I'm like, you should just quit. I don't know why you're doing this.
Did you use a Valley Girl accent?
That's pretty much what I sounded like, too, in those days. I had a higher voice, too. But
well,
no.
Financially, he should have quit.
He was making good money. It wasn't.
For those years, there was some money.
It was
oh, before I got there.
Yeah.
I was only for the.
No, really, it was before.
For the
really,
famine time you brought me in?
No, it was a couple
I mean,
years.
It wasn't a lot
Well,
of
actually,
money,
I was doing more medical service stuff there then.
Let's just say he made as much H&Ps. Doing that as he makes on his other podcast, which is a very
So funny. It's just amazing that we all survived and we're all here.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
But he did it out of the bottom of his heart, and he did it for the people. And I had no idea he had all these rock stars
It
he
was
worked
fun
for.
There, though.
Yeah,
it
we
was
had
really
good,
fun.
Yeah,
but it was hard to turn it off.
And then, but the medical part weighed on me a little heavier even than the addiction part.
And it's funny because when we were dating in our 20s, I used to stay at Los Encinas. I don't know if I should tell anybody this, but they had like a little bungalow in the back for him. And I'd come visit him.
I'd have to stay the night there.
Way back,
and I still
way back
had no
behind,
idea what he was
I know
was
the
doing.
Bungalow you're talking about.
Yeah.
Next to the locked adolescent unit. There's a house over
there.
Yeah, there's
a house
little...
on the way out.
Yeah, on the next... by the back gate.
Yeah,
they tried to Roland tried to give me and Buddy Arnold that building,
that.
So we'd have all a map base there.
Yeah. So
no,
we were...
he wanted you to take that house
yeah,
behind
the house.
That. Behind
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, different one.
Yeah, but he, you know, Drew was working really hard. I had no idea for what 15, 20 years what he did. 15 years, right?
Then you and I put it on TV.
And here
and
we
like,
are.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
So,
it was fun.
All right. Listen, let's wrap this thing
up. It helped
a
lot of people. Maybe
that
it didn't help
goal.
Us, but it helped a lot
no,
of people.
No, the goal was to make a difference, and I think we did it.
I think we did.
Yeah. All right, well.
I liked the Colonel. He said, after you guys get off the phone, did you hang up? Did you stop? He said that he thought it was funny when you guys started arguing about American history.
We always do.
He was
but
really
I don't
nice.
Think we're wrong as a matter of who started or who ended up with it.
Well,
I just have a childhood memory of my uncle being so mad at Ronald Reagan that he wouldn't switch course.
That makes sense to me. But people miss the part that 1963 is where it happened.
Right.
Yeah,
and 2019 is where we have 50,000 people walking around psychotic in Los Angeles.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. All right, we'll see you next time.
With that happy note.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life.
Thanks for listening and subscribing on your favorite platforms. Rate us 5 stars and tell a friend. Also, be sure to visit drdrew.com for the latest news. We'll tell you where you can find all of our health-related content, including the latest in-depth series, The History of Opium. You can now listen to it on the weekly Infusion podcast. We have some great and very interesting and appropriate interviews with key historical players in the history of opium. We're excited about our newest podcast, Dr. Drew After Dark, which has been described as a dark web reboot of Loveline. It's the hottest guest spot for all the most popular comedians. Beware, it is for a mature audience. It is kind of a reboot of Loveline. You can hear the episodes first in a podcast form Thursday. Then on Friday, you can watch all the video episodes when the YouTube page drops on the Your Mom's House YouTube channel. New episodes every week. Subscribe, tell a friend. Also on Doctor.com, you can find Swole Patrol, our health and fitness podcast with Mike Catherwood. If you want something a bit more refined that will expand your intellectual horizons, please subscribe to the Dr. Drew podcast, where I feature a wide variety of very interesting and important guests. Get in-depth interviews there. Last but not least, me and Adam, Adam and Dr. Drew Show podcast. It's a lot of fun, and we are still together, and you can get it 5 days a week. So go to drdrew.com. Please tell a friend, and we thank you for it.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.